problem. God supplies the water, and even mankind to work and develop vegetation in the garden and so on. So that's the logic of it. And my whole point is very simple, is that it simply takes for granted that God would not put vegetation in the ground until the normal conditions for its surviving and thriving and growing existed. That is, until there was a normal supply of water. And so then he supplies the water, and from then on we have the account of how there were plants, and especially how there is the Garden of Eden, and there's the man who was placed there. And of course, it's all leading up to chapter 3. Why bring together vegetation and man? It's setting the stage for chapter 3. Man in the Garden of Eden with the trees, this realm of vegetation is going to provide these features which are so critical in man's whole covenantal obedience and so on. And so that's why it's being dealt with there. Now then, natural providence then is assumed. Try to accommodate that on any of you that takes the days sequentially. Now, it's especially those, you see, who believe in the authority of Scripture and the harmony of Scripture. You can't have a passage over here assuming something that contradicts the passage over here as you're interpreting. You've got to change your interpretation so that there's no more conflict there. And now, where does vegetation appear? Let's take it, suppose things are sequential. Vegetation, of course, occurs on day 3. The land, vegetation, when are the sun and moon and stars created? Here we're back to that question of day 4 again. They're created. And the rest of the solar system out there, in fact, the rest of the cosmos is created here on day 4. What's the problem then, of course? Well, you know, if God wouldn't put in the plants before they had a natural supply of water, he wouldn't put in the plants before there was the natural and so on, and so you're saying that the events of day 4 follow the events of day 3, bringing into a contradiction with this over here. And then, you know, there are other types of problems, and I'm no scientist, and many of you know much more about this, but isn't it the case then that clearly not all kinds of plant life were produced before any animal life was produced? Now that's the way it would be on a straightforward Genesis narrative follows the chronological sequence. All the flora are produced on day 3, none of the fauna until after that, and yet you're all familiar with cases of symbiotic relationships of plants and animals that the one that can't live without the other. And so that there is that kind of problem. Of course, there's the humongous problem, especially for those who hold to the day-age view and who want to insist on there's this beautiful harmony, they say, between what they uncover as the actual process from the Big Bang on. And if you look at Genesis 1, the sequence there, but day 4, you know, day 4, well on into this sequence here, according to them, is where you have the origin of everything but planet Earth. So for the first, up to that point, planet Earth has been existing here, spinning alone, a speck in empty space. In fact, the concept of space doesn't even make sense to speak about empty space, does it? The Earth is spinning along here in a void. And then we come to day 4, and now, not only our immediate solar system, but our galaxy and the super galaxies and all the rest of the whole cosmos is then brought into being. That harmonizes with modern science? No. And that's not the natural way. See, God could have, sure, God could have created planet Earth all by its lonesome here in a void and done everything vegetation and life into existence. He could have, but according to Genesis 2:5, he didn't. He didn't do things that way. So that's it, okay? So here are a couple of arguments for you to think about that should keep you from insisting that the narrative sequence is the chronological one. That is to say, you should be led to recognize the account as figurative. I better let it go at that. And any, give you a question or two chance. There were some on the break, so I imagine some things are going through your mind, but yes.
You dealt briefly, I guess, in a footnote in that article on whether that should be treated as vegetation in general, or some have argued that it's not just vegetation in general.
Yeah, like it doesn't affect my argument one way or the other. I could take it either way. Or I could take it as referring either to the Garden of Eden locally, or I could take it as referring to the earth as a whole, and then either way, it doesn't affect the logic of this thing. So that's why it's already
not just scope, but also the I guess if you mean Garden of Eden as being what it refers to, refers to plants of the field or herbs of the field, and not just plants in general.
Yeah, yeah. Even if it refers then to the Garden of Eden, it is something that has happened before man was created. And so it's something. It's a situation that obtains within the period of the 6 days. And so whether it's local or global, doesn't matter to me. Whether local or global, natural providential procedure is in effect.
Do you preface your statement, your argument, that all this creative activity was absolutely confined to these 6 days?
Was absolutely
confined to these 6 days because of the argument that some of these plants may have been made later?
No, at that point I was just actually had more in mind something like I was trying to say that all significant variety has come into being within that period, so that even if, let's say, you were trying to argue for some sort of an evolutionary principle as accounting for some of it, that would have been a principle that was operating only within those that period of the 6 days, which is now closed. And so that you couldn't be looking for verification from an experimental process conducted today along those lines.
No, some have argued that God held off creating the shrubs of the field because their nature would be affected by man's fall, as to whether they would be weeds or not.
I didn't get your point, that they would be affected by what?
Whether man fell or not, that they would take on a different nature. Hypothesized as a reason that their creation was held off until that point. The ones that the certain plants had not begun to grow, and the argument would be that they existed in seed form, but they had not grown out of the earth because they had not been cultivated. The other shrubs of the field did not exist at all and would not exist until after fall, which became weeds, and it refers to the use of the word.
A couple of things are going on there. I think one is the we were there when we were discussing with someone what the effect of the curse was on nature, and I would dispute that the fall had that kind of an effect on nature at all in the first place, and we'll come to that later on. For the particular meaning of the terminology of those plants, let me refer you to an article that was written by someone who was my colleague until just this fall. Out in Westminster in California. His name is Mark Butato. And I wrote the article because it had not rained. And in a recent issue of the Westminster Theological Journal, just two or three issues back, Mark, supporting my view and giving an exegesis of the kind of thing you're interested in, wrote an article called Because It Had Rained. Not contradicting mine, actually, mm-hmm. very supportive of it. But if you can find that one, I think you'll find it helpful in terms of the meaning of the different shrubs and so on. He did his doctoral degree at some in the area of climate and nature and that sort of thing. So,
how do you spell his last
name? Futato. Westminster Journal, within the last year or so. The other points.
Are you saying you would argue against the fall affecting nature?
Yeah, and when we come to it, we will try to make the point, like, you know, passages like the Romans 8, 1, that everyone appeals to, of all the creation groaning and travail and so on. I'll try to deal with that one, so that's not what it's talking about at all, but it's really taken over from Isaiah 24 and following, where he's talking about the idea of resurrection. But it's a big subject, and we will come to it. But who was I discussing that with? Oh, yeah. We were making that point over here. And just to repeat what I was saying on the break, my understanding of it then is that the fall did not change anything in nature, as though we could assume that until that time, all nature was, as I usually try to put it, one big marshmallow that could not hurt man, you know. Huh? Creation was full of things that could damage man before the fall. Huh? There were cliffs that you could fall off. Hmm? There were bodies of water in which you could drown. There were rocks that you could stub your foot against. There were all kinds of things in nature before the fall that were threatening to man. Why, as a matter of fact, before the fall, was man not victimized by any of these things? Well, because the Lord will give his angels charge over the one who's in his favor so that they don't stub their foot against the stone. So the secret of happiness and blessedness in the Garden of Eden before the fall was not that the world was different, but that man enjoyed God's sovereign absolute control. And God controls to the last detail whether your toe strikes a stone or whether a leaf falls from a tree or anything like that. And such is God's sovereign control that would guarantee the blessedness of man in spite of the presence of these alarming things. So it is not the absence of the stone, but it's the presence of God's favor that makes it a situation of happiness. And on the contrary, when God removes his favor, then you do strike your foot against a stone. Then you do get drowned. Then you do fall off cliffs and so on. It's an expression now of the... What has changed then is not the nature of nature. What has changed is man's relationship to God, and as a result of that, the way in which God uses nature either to bless or to victimize man. So as I understand it, there's no biblical evidence there were thorns and thistles in the garden beforehand. There was death in the world beforehand. Huh? Death all along the line up until human death, but not human death. Death was serving man up to that point. Hmm? The death of other things was serving the higher interests of man. After the fall, man becomes himself subject to death. Before the fall, the ground produces the vegetation, which fattens the calf, and the vegetation and the calf together feed the man. After the fall, man, dust unto dust, man feeds the dust, and he begins to push up the daisies. He's serving vegetation and so on. That's the difference between the two situations. But I think it is just an idealistic, idyllic, non-existent, non-biblical concept that traditionally has taken over the paradise. You know, everything idyllic, one big marshmallow. I mean, that's not the biblical picture. Is more strongly theological. It all depends on God and how He uses all these things. I won't have to say it when we come to it. Now we've already done that.
If we're there, I guess ask the question about the curse. The curse is, I always thought, was on the ground.
Yeah,
you could imply that the curse was really on the ground.
Yeah. And what's interesting, check the language that's used when it comes to the story of the flood, and you find that the same language is used there of God's cursing the ground, but actually what it means is that God used the realm of nature in order to affect man. So, the way you put it was really right. That it's really man that's being cursed and via through the agency of nature. So,
I thought you were implying that he was cursed by the removal of some of divine protection rather than by a change in nature.
That's it. And on the other hand, it says that God now curses the ground with respect to man. All right, it is God's sovereign control over the realm of nature. Now no longer to protect him, but now to punish him.
Not to get too far off, but the eternal state.
The eternal state, yeah.
Will nature continue?
No, not yeah. my next book, if the Lord lets me ever write it, it's going to be called God, Heaven, and Armageddon. The Armageddon might sound mysterious, but you know, we were talking about the Garden of Eden. and the mountain of God, the mountain of God, in the Garden of Eden, that's Armageddon. We said heaven, this is another one of those points of replication I could have used as an illustration. Heaven is where God sits and says, let us do such and such. He sits in the middle of the divine council up on the heights of heaven. One of the reproductions of that in earthly symbolism is Armageddon, the mountain, and Mageddon means assembly. It has nothing to do with Megiddo, by the way. It's the Mount of Assembly. It's the place where God is in the midst of the assembly of his heavenly agents. And at last, that's where the church is. Huh? That's our eternal destiny, is the heights of Armageddon, which is a symbol for heaven. And I got on this track. What was your question? Oh, what you said, what was heaven? Okay, what was heaven like? Yeah, so I started to say I'm writing this book on God, heaven, and Armageddon, which is an earthly symbol for heaven, and so that is heaven. And in the first chapter of that book, I'm trying to deal with your question, because the real question is, how do you relate biblical cosmology, mm-hmm. biblical view of the heaven with this two-registered thing and all, how do you relate that to the view of the cosmos as it is being produced by modern science? And all kinds of questions arise. When this world passes away, what is that referring to? When there's a new heavens and a new earth, how much discontinuity is there between the world as we know it and the world as it will be? If it's going to be rather continuous with the world as we now know it, will heaven, the eternal state, be one in which the cosmos is expanding? We're an expanding universe, all right? Will these dynamics continue in heaven? Or if there's too much matter and therefore too much gravity, and therefore we are heading not for a continuing expansion, but for a big crunch again. What will happen to the saints up there when that big crunch takes place? Are all the rules changed? Is the cosmos completely different than the one these are the kinds of things that I was suggesting before, the kinds of questions, and evidently you're a good example of it, that people are interested in them, and we should be addressing them. And so I'm trying to struggle with this and do something. Will there be animals in heaven? How to take these passages in Isaiah and elsewhere that speak about the wild animals, the predators lying down in peace with their former lamb chops, and all of this, you know. Will there still be animals? There are all kinds of fascinating questions that let's think about that, you know, that all the dimensions of reality that we are presently have access to, I think, will be available, plus now the invisible dimensions. And when the glory of heaven suffuses the whole world, and there's a coalescence of the upper and lower registers in our experience, which takes place when we're glorified, and our eyes are open to the whole thing, it will continue to be a physical existence. The resurrection of the body demands it. And that's the way I think the debate often goes, is heaven now something that is completely vaporized, spiritualized, or is there a solid physical dimension to it? And I think the resurrection of the body demands the latter, and yet transformed in ways that are beyond our present conceptualizing, and so we hardly know what language to use, and we stumble along with language like new dimensions, huh? New dimensions, and just a label for something, for a mystery. And I guess tonight we can at least talk about the definition of covenant, and do something with an overview of the covenants. Kingdom Prologue with you. In terms of the opening pages, it's actually the introduction. Now, page one. So what we are basically trying to do in this course is to provide this covenantal kingdom foundation things, as we call it, where God administers his kingdom through a series of covenants. And we want to understand what is their nature, what's their relationship to one another, so that we can see where we fit into the whole scheme, or where it is going. And covenant is there with its covenant theology is what we're doing. It just so happens that covenant is so basic to God's kingdom administration that you can't deal with the drama of creation history without dealing with this series of covenants that define the whole process. And now, in the middle of that page, then I start to get into the evidence for a definition. Isn't that profound or difficult? I think all you have to do is take a concordance and look up the word covenant, which would be a translation then of the Hebrew berit in the old Hebrew, or in diatheke for the Greek, and just read down through the concordance the phrases that have to do with covenant, their immediate context. And you'll find out some things very quickly. The question I pose then in the middle of the page is, of the biblical words rendered covenant, the primary one in the Old Testament, berit, the Greek, diatheke, and what is it that constitutes now? What is it that constitutes the peculiar berit character of that which is so denominated? If the Bible refers to some transaction as a berit, why is that particular translation transaction of berit? What is there about a berit that you find there? Well, you'll find as you go down your list over and again that the berit is something that is made. You make the covenant. Actually, the Hebrew word for it is karat, which means to cut a covenant, and we'll be noticing why that particular word, but in any case, you make a covenant. And how do you make it? You turn to some of those passages and you find yourself reading that there's a very solemn thing that happens there. It's accomplished through a solemn process of ratification. And characteristically, this transaction centers in the swearing of an oath. So when covenants are there, they are made solemnly and characteristically by an oath, and an oath involves a curse. An oath is a sort of a conditional self-malediction. A curse is a conditional self-malediction. I swear that I will do such and such, and God do so unto me and more also if I fail. So I am invoking a curse upon myself conditionally if I fail. But that's the way covenants are made then, by the making of a solemn commitment, and especially through oath. So clearly a berit is a legal kind of arrangement. It's a formal disposition of a binding nature involved with oath. At the heart of a berit is an act of commitment. And that's the essence of it. The heart of a berit is an act of commitment, and the customary oath form of this commitment reveals the religious nature of this transaction. You know, it's not like a secular contract. You swear by God. Mm-hmm. It's a religious phenomenon, this thing. And so it is no mere secular contract, but rather belongs to the sacred sphere of divine witness and enforcement. The kind of legal disposition called berit consists then in this. It consists in divinely sanctioned commitment. Now that's the heart of what I want to say. A berit is a transaction involving a divinely sanctioned commitment. Someone makes a commitment, and it may be God. Let's say God himself may make the commitment. And of course, it's then divinely sanctioned because of the fact that he makes it. Or if it is a human being, and let's take Israel at Mount Sinai, Exodus 19-24. Israel there makes the commitment. All that the Lord has spoken and said, we will do. So Israel takes the act of commitment, but they do it in the presence of God, with God as the witness and the enforcer of the thing, and so it is a divinely sanctioned commitment. Now that is the essence of covenant. A good indication that this is the case, that the act of commitment with the obligations thus undertaken is basic to the meaning, is provided by the numerous statements about keeping and remembering. This is another thing. You look down your concordance list and you'll find yourself not just reading about making the covenant, but over and again about keeping the covenant, or the opposite of breaking the covenant. Keeping and breaking, of course, refers to commitments that have been made, the oath that has been taken, and so this underscores the same thought. You can read the on your own the rest maybe of the introduction that points to the presence of other synonyms for berit, like the word for a curse. You see, you make a covenant by swearing an oath, and an oath is a verbalization, sometimes also an actual dramatization of the curse that you want to befall you. And so the idea of a curse attached to commitment, the word curse sometimes becomes used as a synonym for berit. In fact, so much, top of page 2, so much was the oath commitment definitive of berit that the act of making a berit, as I just said, was denoted by the imagery of the oath ritual performed when ratifying a berit. All right, so as I said, an oath is a conditional self-malediction. You swear to do something, and you can verbalize the curse that you expect to befall you if you break the covenant, or you can symbolize it. You can perform a ritual. You can dramatize the thing. And it just so happens that the characteristic ritual for symbolizing the curse of an oath there and making covenants and whatnot was that you take an animal and you kill it, you cut it up. And so what you are saying is, look, may God do so unto me. May he cut me all up in pieces like this animal if I break my covenant. And so my point is that so much of the essence of covenant is this business of the oath and the curse, that the characteristic form of the curse of cutting an animal becomes the term for making a covenant. So you make a covenant by cutting an animal, symbolizing a curse, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So there are various lines of evidence then that indicate this is the heart of the thing. There's one other whole line of evidence that has to do, and I'll come back to that in a moment, that has to do with comparing the biblical covenants with the covenants that exist in the ancient world of the Bible. And as I say, I'll come back to that in just a second. But the rest of that chapter then involves maybe just expanding the definition of covenant a little bit to take account of its function. So the idea of the covenant in itself is that it is a divinely sanctioned commitment. Now, if you want to work into your definition something of how do covenants function, what do they do? Well, as we've just been saying, the ones we're interested here in the Bible are instruments whereby God administers his kingdom. So here is God at work, and he uses covenants as a legal kind of instrument in order to define his covenant. He gives a covenant to a people as a constitution for the organization of the kingdom. So that would be a somewhat more complete definition, including the function. Divinely sanctioned commitment, functioning as instruments of the administration of God's kingdom. Now, I would let it go at that. In the rest of the chapter, I'm criticizing some other definitions that have been that have emerged within the context of our own context of churches and seminaries and so on, and in particular, I have in view here the definition presented by John Murray, systematics professor in Westminster of past fame, And another one, then I actually mentioned his name last week, was Palmer Robertson, because I said I had been reading one of Palmer Robertson's books. Now, John Murray was my professor when I was a student, and then Palmer Robertson was my student, so there's three generations there. So I like to criticize my professor, and Palmer Robertson likes to criticize his professor, which in this case is me. And so at this point, I'm criticizing both my professor and my student here at the end of this chapter.
You all failed. You all failed.
Yeah, we all failed. And so John Murray's definition was this. Murray defined a covenant as a sovereign administration of grace and promise. Right? It's a sovereign administration of grace and promise. See, he's got hold of the idea of this is God sovereignly administering his kingdom, and so far so good. Now the problem comes in with the additional words of grace and promise, making that part of the definition of covenant. Murray's definition would be an excellent definition of some of the covenants in the Bible, like the New Covenant. And the New Covenant is the sovereign administration of grace and promise. That's fine. Now the problem with it is that not all the things that the Bible calls bereath, and not all the cases of the divine human covenants in the Bible were arrangements of grace and promise. And this gets us into one huge problem and debate that we'll have to deal with thoroughly, and which you should expect to encounter in, again, these ecclesiastical and seminary circles in which we are all moving. And the problem, in a nutshell, then, with Murray's definition is that, look, in the history of covenant theology, we have always spoken about a covenant of works at the beginning, haven't we? Hmm? There's a covenant of works, God's covenant with Adam. And then there's the covenant of grace and so on. Now, covenant of grace fits Murray's definition. That's a sovereign administration of grace and promise, the sovereign grace of God that we rejoice in. But now what about the covenant of works? That doesn't fit his definition. He realized it didn't, and so he opposed the tradition. You know, Murray is usually thought of as this, the one who was the conservative one who stuck with the tradition. And if I may say so, yours truly is usually thought of as the maverick who is going in some different directions, as with the interpretation of the days of Genesis or something. But on this particular thing, I'm the traditionalist, and Murray's the innovator. And he acknowledged that he was taking it upon himself to refurbish the whole history of covenant the theology, so he would no longer speak about a covenant of works, because he recognized with his definition that's a contradiction in terms. Covenant's a grace, works is the opposite of grace, and so he would no longer speak about a covenant of works. And for a while he wouldn't use the word covenant at all in describing God's relationship to Adam in the beginning, and he would just talk about the Adamic administration, which is sort of non-committal when it comes to this works and grace. But that's my problem with his definition, then, that it if you're going to have a definition for purposes of an overall covenant theology, it has to fit them all, and his won't do that. And now what that led to, actually, as we'll be seeing, is that the idea of a covenant of works as of works, the principle of works itself, began then to be eliminated. Eventually, he did come around to using the word covenant for a second stage in those arrangements with Adam. He conceived of some original state before there was a covenant, and this was a big mistake to do that. In which there was perfect justice functioning. But then the covenant comes in, and once the covenant comes in, on his definition, grace comes in. And so an element of grace now gets injected into that situation, which traditionally we have been calling a covenant of works, as something in contrast to grace. You're beginning no longer to have black and white, works and grace. You're beginning to have something gray, which is a works arrangement, which yet is a grace arrangement, and that's where all the mischief begins. And it is real mischief, because the the net result is that it undercuts the gospel of saving grace, which is certainly not Murray's intention, but that is the effect of ultimately what's happening. And so this is a huge thing that you're going to have to think about. If you're going to go out and you're going to be a preacher of the gospel, you're going to be a teacher of the gospel, and you don't have this straight, I'd rather you stay at home and not preach. Because this is the gospel of grace is the thing that's at stake in this thing. Now, the other definition is the one that Palmer Robertson came up with. And on his definition, he emphasized that in all covenants, that there is the effecting of a bond, an intimate love, religious bond of some kind. So that's his definition, that this particular effect is insisted upon as part of the covenant reality. And again, the problem is, that's fine for the new covenant, but it doesn't fit all covenants at all. Certainly, the acme of the new covenant is that wonderful religious bond of close fellowship that we have with the Lord in the covenant. But that feature simply is not present in all covenants. As a matter of fact, and this is the one I was referring to last week, here you have, along with the covenants of works and the covenants of grace that we're talking about, you have the covenant of common grace. Here's a covenant that God makes with everybody. And now, there is no sweet, religious, loving fellowship that God establishes with everybody. That simply is not the case. In the covenant of common grace, God provides for a certain order of nature and a certain order for society with particular institutions like the state, which involve common privilege for both believers and unbelievers, but it doesn't involve a close, intimate union with Christ type of religious bond, such as Palmer Robertson is defining with identifying with the covenant. And so once again, you have to be careful not to add features to your definition that aren't true of all covenants. I think Murray's and Robertson's definitions have that problem. I don't think the one I'm suggesting does. So covenants then are divinely sanctioned commitments which function as instruments of God's kingdom, are making it broad enough to include the common grace element, you might say, of God's kingship. God's kingship. All right, that's pages 1 through 5. Now, as I said, my approach is very much the traditional one on this, and so this should sound familiar to you if you've been involved at all in reading or thinking in your theology about the subject of the covenant. And so I would set things up this way. As we said, the covenants are function as instruments of God's kingdom or kingship, so we might put that word up then at the top. And there is the creation kingdom, and there's the recreation kingdom. Or the redemptive kingdom. Now then, there is the covenant of creation, you might call it. One covenant of creation, and there are the covenants, plural, of redemption. This covenant of creation, let's give a name to it, that describes it a little bit, and I would call it the Creator's covenant of works, right? Traditional stuff. The Creator's covenant of works with Adam. And of course, in the light of Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15 and so on, the two Adam scheme, we know that the covenant that God makes with Adam, he isn't just making for Adam by himself, but he's making for Adam as the federal head of the whole of humanity. So it's the covenant of works with Adam as the representative of mankind. Now we want to analyze that a little bit more in a moment, but just to get the whole picture in front of us, first of all, over here, we said there are covenants, plural, of redemption. We know what happens to this one. There is a first stage of probation. And then, had the probation been successful, there would have been a second stage of conferral. I'll come back and fill this all out much more. We'll have to talk a lot about it. But this is part of the works arrangement. It's all part of the goal of the whole thing from the very beginning. See, that there's no pre-covenantal situation. There's no order of nature or anything like that before him. When God creates the world, it's a covenantal creation. He creates a covenant into existence when he creates it. That's all the only game in town. There's nothing else. And so there's nothing before the covenant. And the covenant itself, from the very beginning, is eschatological. That is, from the very beginning, what is envisaged is the consummation. This is not some second thought or something, but from the very beginning, it was God's intention to bring his people up there with him, as we were saying, up to the upper register, up to the seventh day, to join with him in his heavenly rest. That would be the consummation. That's been God's purpose from the very beginning. That was the goal of the covenant that he set up with Adam, heaven, the consummation, that glorified state of things. And heaven has to be earned. Now that's a principle, an eschatological principle that comes out. Heaven has to be earned. You have to work for it and get it as a reward. God himself did it that way in the story of creation. We went through the story of creation. Here's another way you can tell that story of creation. The story of God's works, huh? He performed his kingdom works as he created his kingdom into existence over the 6 days. And then, as he performed his work, day by day, he pronounced the word of judgment on his works, and he saw that they were good. And so day by day, he pronounced a word of approbation. Approbation, a judgment of approbation followed. And because he had performed the work and he could pronounce it good and approve of it, then he had earned the reward of the Sabbath, the seventh day. Now that's the pattern of eschatology. That's the basic structure of history. The basic structure of history has always been eschatology. It's not just flat. It's not cyclical, like pagan thought. The creation history from the beginning has intended to be, and is nothing else but a thrust toward consummation, a thrust toward heaven, and via a process of earning it through probationary works, which of course God in his covenant will assign. This is another one of the ways in which the upper register replicates itself on earth. That's the way God did it. He earned his Sabbath rest by fulfilling the works which received his own verdict of approbation. That's the pattern that he repeats on earth with his image bearer. Man too, God is an eschatological God moving to consummation, and man therefore does the same, and he too must earn it. He must merit the thing by his works. And so after his successful probation, that would be his works, then proceeds the conferring of the blessing sanctions of the covenant in two stages. Since I'm into this, let me just pull it out a little bit more. In two stages, the conferral would take place. Heaven itself was the second stage. Glorification wouldn't happen at once. Here's Adam and Eve. They've passed the probation, but you know, part of their general assignment was to fill the earth, populate it, fill it, and subdue it. They haven't done that yet. And in fact, they can't procreate and populate the world if right away God would glorify their bodies, because when our bodies are glorified, Jesus tells the Sadducees, then we are like the angels in heaven. No marry or given marriage anymore. And so Adam and Eve couldn't be glorified at once, or they couldn't fulfill this general cultural mandate, as we call it, that had also been given to them in this particular covenant. So they must continue with their earthy bodies. You know, the 1 Corinthians 15 tells us we've had the earthy body like Adam, and then we have the likeness of the man from heaven afterwards. But first, the earthy body, the procreation given marriage, that type of body. And so there would have been a period of history when it was no longer able to fall. They passed their probation. And this is a wonderful concept now that we should get into our gospel preaching.